Democrats have their first official gubernatorial candidate for 2020. State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick goes on tour with Eddie Melton. That, plus Hail for Congress and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 12, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, healthcare executive and former state health commissioner Woody Myers announced he's running for governor. Myers, a physician, has only run for public office once before, for Congress in 2008, and never a statewide campaign. But he says he's not worried whether he has the experience necessary for a gubernatorial bid.
I've been a businessman. I've been involved in politics. I am a physician. I've been in state government, in the public sector. I've been in the private sector. I've been in the not-for-profit sector.
Still, Myers also hints that not spending a career in politics could be an asset.
I'm running for governor because Indiana has too many pre-existing conditions that typical politicians just can't treat.
Among the issues Myers cites, inadequate teacher pay and education funding, poor maternal and infant mortality rates, and rising health care costs. Is Woody Myers the right candidate for Indiana Democrats? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Jennifer Hollowell, is there something appealing about someone who hasn't spent a career in and around politics?
Well, I think those things generally depend on the race and the environment that you're looking at. In this case, though, I don't necessarily think he is an outsider either. You know, he spent several years in and around politics. He was a political appointee. He spent, I think, a couple million dollars of his own money running unsuccessfully for a different race. So it isn't as if he's an outsider.
I don't think he's calling himself necessarily an outsider entirely.
Yeah. I mean, what I think is probably the biggest challenge is he's running against Governor Holcomb. Governor Holcomb's very popular. I don't think he offers any special contrast or message against the governor. And I don't think Democrats are really that enthusiastic about him, except for the fact that they think he might put some of his own money in, but I doubt that it would be the millions that you would need to make this race more competitive.
And he said he's not going to self-fund this
campaign. I don't think he's going to have to self-fund this candidate. I think the only reason that you think that Eric Holcomb is popular is because he's popular with some Republicans who know him. Most people don't know him, and most people don't think he's done a thing since he's been in the governor's office. And he has no ID in terms of name recognition among the public, and he's been presiding over an administration which, between the VA and now the scandals about the virtual schools, as Eric Holcomb, when he was state chair of the Republican Party, used to say, it's a culture of corruption. And here he is right there in charge of it. So there's a lot to run against, and the fact that we haven't used the resources of the state to invest wisely, we haven't paid the teachers adequately, there are lots of issues there that I think people are going to be very sympathetic. And his background as a doctor, particularly since Indiana ranks horribly, not just with infant mortality, but with obesity, with smoking, with all of the indicators of health, we are at the bottom of the 50 states. And are we addressing that with Governor Holcomb? Not on your life. So it's a good message.
Jennifer talks about something. Is there something that distinguishes Woody Myers from Eric Holcomb or even his fellow candidates? Well, not that he has any quite yet, fellow potential candidates. Is there something that makes Woody Myers stand out?
Well, obviously his experience in healthcare is something that, you know, Governor Holcomb doesn't have, as I'm sure there are attributes that Governor Holcomb has that Dr. Woody Myers doesn't have. Obviously, he has run health departments with hundreds of people. I mean, I don't think anyone's
saying... Appointed by governors of both parties.
Both parties. Right. And I think he definitely has the experience for it. We'll see how he does running statewide.
Obviously, I mean, the sign said Dr. Woody Myers for governor, and he did it out in front of a former hospital. Obviously, he's trying to make healthcare at the forefront, and of course he would. Can it be the top issue when voters go to the polls in November, or is that too out of his control?
It's largely out of his control, but certainly health care is an issue that's never far from the front burner, given the controversy over the Affordable Care Act or the attempts to unravel the Affordable Care Act without a seeming obvious replacement there to put in its place. So it's as good as
it
any.
It can be the dominant
it
issue.
It can be the dominant issue, and if it is,
I mean, in a state race, if you look at state polling for the last several election cycles, you're not going to see health care in the top three.
Oh, yeah, you are, because of
you're
Curtis
see jobs
Hill.
In the economy.
And Curtis
you see
Hill's
taxes,
lawsuit.
You'll see infrastructure.
Yeah, that's
Curtis
what that's
Hill's
what
lawsuit is going to make it.
I will say doctors, whatever it is about Hoosiers, they love voting for doctors, whether it's for governor, Congress, coroner. Now, coroner's an easy one because a lot of them are to begin with. But one thing that's going to be interesting is, and that sounded an awful lot like an endorsement.
Well, Curtis Hill.
Well, he is
Curtis
the only candidate
well,
so far.
But I think that'll be on a save key, and I think we'll hear that played again because, well, Barron Hill, former congressman, clearly is in his camp and introduced him the other day. I think a lot of other people are saying nice things but are not willing yet to say, this is my guy.
We don't know who the field is yet. Yeah. But the other part of that is it is going to be an issue in Indiana because in the latest position that Donald Trump has taken on the Affordable Care Act, like his fifth or sixth position, he is now saying that those states that have brought suit, where it's pending in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, if they win on that, then they should be able to get rid of Obamacare, which means 400 and some 1,000 Hoosiers will lose their health care coverage, will lose coverage for pre-existing conditions, will lose coverage for lifetime caps, and it's all thanks to Curtis Hill.
Race, like you said. Well, Republican State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick joined State Senator Eddie Melton this week on his gubernatorial exploratory committee statewide listening tour. Melton announced the listening tour last month when he formed the Exploratory Committee for Governor. The announcement of McCormick's involvement came last week. Melton says she will join him for stops on the tour to, quote, share her expertise and passion about education. In a statement, McCormick says Indiana needs more statewide leaders who value the voices of practitioners and community stakeholders, and says Melton is one of those leaders. She also says decisions about education should be at the heart of the 2020 election. That election will mark the first time the state superintendent position isn't on the ballot. Lawmakers made the role an appointed one after McCormick was elected in 2016. Indiana GOP Chair Kyle Hupfer blasted McCormick, questioning whether she was still a Republican. Ann Delaney, Kyle Hupfer says McCormick is auditioning for a new job as a lieutenant governor candidate for Democrats. Is he right?
You know, what's absolutely shameful about that attack is that she is the only Republican standing up for the 93% of the students that are in public education. Okay, the rest of the party, nobody wants to talk about the fact that we're underpaying teachers. Nobody wants to talk about the fact that we're not monitoring either virtual schools or charter schools. We don't know whether the students, you know, all in the interest of choice, they've been giving millions and millions and millions of state tax dollars away with no results and no oversight. All they want to do, they don't want to admit that they're against public education, but that's what the Republican Party is. They're against public education. And she's the one person in the Republican Party to stand up for those 93% of the students. You'd think they'd be giving her accolades. Instead, they're attacking her. So, you know, Hupfer ought to start looking inside the Republican Party and how they're going to explain to the parents of those 93% of the students why they don't fund public education properly.
Is Jennifer McCormick auditioning for a new job?
I definitely think she is. I definitely think she's trying to run for lieutenant governor or something on the Democrat side. And, I mean, look, honestly, she voted Democrat several election cycles voted Republican. So it's not all that surprising.
So
but it is incredibly disappointing for Republicans who voted for her and who supported her financially and volunteer-wise and you know, all throughout her campaign and since then, it's incredibly disappointing.
So
and Republicans
Republican
do support public
it?
Education. As you remember, we just came out of this legislative session where we increased funding for K-12 schools by hundreds of millions of dollars.
Most of which is going to virtual and charter schools.
No,
that's right.
Not true at all.
Much heavier that's percentage that's going to the regular schools. It is.
If she is auditioning for the role of lieutenant governor or the first ever secretary of education in modern times, would that be something that Democrats would be okay with?
Sure. I don't see why not. I mean, the point is, I mean, it is fact that she had voted Democratic in the past. I think a lot of us were watching when she was elected to say, wonder how this will turn out, because her track record clearly had been one of a strong advocate of public education, traditional public education, seemed to be saying a lot of the things that teachers wanted to hear, even the teachers' unions wanted to hear. So I guess we shouldn't be so surprised that this seems to be a better fit ideologically in terms of party affiliation for her. But I think we live in an era where crossing over does not spell the demise of one's political career. I mean, hey, Ronald Reagan did it. Mike Pence did it. I would guess even Donald Trump had done it. I mean, people, I think, we're past that. And I think what she brings to the table, of course, is the same thing we just talked about with Woody Myers. If health care is the issue, he's well situated. If education, and we always can stipulate education is always going to be an issue, well, then she's naturally well situated as well.
What does this do for Eddie Melton?
I think it definitely helps. I mean, I think a lot of people are listening to what she has to say, and it brings some extra attention to his listening tour. So smart move on his behalf. I'm not at all surprised, given how independent Jennifer McCormick has been. She's very eloquent. She's very passionate. And, you know, I remember writing my profiles, and Ritz and her really agreed on the issues. And so we always knew that was going to maybe come up. And then you throw in a couple years of the Republican Party basically marginalizing and just not listening to a word that came out of her mouth. And, you know, she's trying something new.
All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we post an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: would State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick, a Republican, make a good lieutenant governor candidate for Democrats in 2020? A yes or B, no. Last week's question: will Pete Buttigieg be the Democratic nominee for president in 2020? 65% of you now say yes, which is a huge jump from when we last asked that question in April. 18% say no, and 17% say it is still too early to tell. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, former state representative and lieutenant governor candidate Christina Hale announced this week she's running for Indiana's 5th congressional district seat. Hale becomes the second Democrat to announce her candidacy since Republican Representative Susan Brooks announced last month that she's not running for re-election. Dee Thornton, who ran against Brooks in 2016, is also running in the Democratic primary. Hale, who most recently was the executive director of youth programs at Kiwanis International, is already trying to distinguish herself from her opposition.
You know, I'm the only person getting in this race so far that actually has a record. So I have a reputation and a record for being collaborative.
John Schwanis, we've already talked on this show about how much the Republican nominee for the 5th District will matter in terms of whether or not Democrats can flip it. But does Christina Hale give her party the best shot?
I think she gives it a really good shot. Attractive candidate. She has the experience. You mentioned it in the introduction that she had been an elected state official, a member of the General Assembly, I should say. She had been a candidate for lieutenant governor. Those are the kind of things where you collect chits that you can, you go around your district, you go around the state, and you get to know people. And those are people who may want to help fund your campaign, who may want to help work for your campaign if they're in the district where you're running. We talk so much about office holders somehow being a detriment, but I think when you're talking about a race like this where it gives you name ID with party, the infrastructure of the party and the people who are going to be there and maybe help in a primary, I don't see a downside.
Christina Hale flipped a General Assembly seat from red to blue, albeit after it was redrawn. But does she give Democrats the best shot to win the seat?
Well, I don't know about best, because who knows how many other candidates are going to be interested. But clearly she's a good candidate. She has experience in the legislature. She has experience running statewide and campaigning. So I definitely think she is a good candidate for the seat.
Can Democrats flip the seat?
Oh, I think they can. And I think that Susan Brooks' resignation, or at least announcement that she was not running again, is an indicator that she thinks that that seat can be flipped. Certainly, I mean, things that we never thought would have ever happened before. I think Joe Donnelly failed to carry the city of Carmel by 17 votes, okay? Can that
made
be flipped?
Up a lot of ground in Hamilton County.
We can flip that seat with the right candidate. And
Christina Hale
is an excellent candidate for that position. She probably won't be the only candidate for that position.
We already know she isn't the only candidate.
But she's an excellent candidate for that position. And I think if we have a woman nominee in that district, I think we're going to win it.
If Christina Hale is the nominee next year, will it still matter a lot more who comes out of the Republican side as to whether or not Republicans can hold on to it?
Well, I do think it matters who comes out of the Republican side because I think that this district has changed. It is a more moderate district. It is a lot more competitive. So some Republicans are going to have to kind of come to that realization that this is not just a safe seat anymore. It's competitive. And so we need to nominate someone who is a...
Reflects the district.
Yeah, reflects the district and is not going to be too far to the right. Like if we nominate someone who's like a Richard Murdoch or something like that, then we could risk losing it. But the good news is I don't think... Right, but I don't think that we will. Right now, there are, good grief, I mean, there are a dozen plus people who are seriously considering running.
You can see why it's an attractive...
Yeah, but among those, honestly, there are several who I think could absolutely win this district, and I'm confident that we will nominate one of those candidates.
The problem is, you've got 12.
I think she's clearly very well-liked, but I don't know that she's the best candidate for them. I mean... I think
well,
that
sure
time will tell whether
rather
that's
have
the case,
a man
but
in there,
we are not going to let
but
this
you're
going
to you're going to have so many candidates that the ability to control it or the ability to put forward the best candidate for the general election is going to be very limited.
The fun thing for reporters is there will be a primary on both sides, and so Democrats are going to have to deal with primary too.
Right.
D's supporters are not going away. I mean,
well,
she ran
they?
Last time, and she's
sure.
going to give it a go.
I agree. That is a fun thing for reporters. The state of Indiana will seek to recover $40 million from a pair of virtual schools that inflated their enrollment numbers. Indiana Virtual Pathways Academy, Indiana Virtual School, and Daleville Community Schools, which authorized the two virtuals, are on the hook to pay back the money. A state audit found the two virtual charters reported twice as many students to the state than were actually taking courses, including some who'd moved out of state and one student who had died. State examiner Paul Joyce says once the full audit is done, criminal charges could be filed if the findings support it. Daleville Community Schools said in a statement following the State Board of Education's meeting on the issue that it is, quote, further proof that greater oversight of charter and virtual charter schools is essential. Nikki Kelly, you pointed out that at the meeting everyone was asking, how did we miss this? In fact, I think you led your article with it.
I did.
So how did they miss this?
Honestly, I think the reason it was missed is because every single entity involved in this had some responsibility and didn't do their job. I know at the state board meeting this week, the board was kind of trying to act like, well, we don't have much authority or responsibility, but there's, you know, they control authorizers, and so everyone missed it. And I would be remiss if I didn't point out that the reason that this came out is because of good journalism. You know, for years, the Chalkbeat Indiana was looking into, oh, look, they have millions, they have no teachers, how did their, you know, enrollment grow this far, this fast? And, you know, no one kind of looked at it. They didn't get audited for years. And so the reason that this came out is because journalists were looking, even if the officials weren't.
The Daleville Community Schools puts out a statement that says, this clearly shows that we need more oversight. Isn't that, I mean, should you have to be told to do oversight in order to do oversight?
Well, it seems to me the idea behind charter schools, not just virtual charter schools, but charter schools in general, was that you would give them freedom from some of the constraints. Well, the idea was some of the peculiarities, the nitty-gritty that people would look at and say, why is that a rule? Nobody, I don't think, in their right mind said, we are supposed to be free of oversight and free of being responsible for what dollars are coming into your coffers and what students you're supposedly producing. One thing that could have been done is somebody could have looked, everybody's saying, you know, how come? Look at any other state. There are a lot of states where this is happening. I mean, the same thing is unfolding. There's seldom, I don't know of a state that is as far down the path as this state is in terms of virtual charter schools that hasn't had something like this. I don't know if it's a situation where the temptation is too significant and the standards are too lax, but it is a problem.
Is Nikki right on this one? Is it everybody has to take the blame here?
Well, I think there are multiple entities, without a doubt, and Daleville took a lot of the blame, I think, in the meeting. But also, back to an earlier topic, what about the superintendent of public instruction, Dr. McCormick? The Department of Education is the entity that gathers all of this data and would have the data that shows thousands of students with zero credits. So it should have been caught.
That is true.
Should have been caught before that. That should be a topic on the listening tour. It should have been caught by the Department of Education.
Yeah, is this everybody has to say, well, everybody was
you
wrong?
You know, the legislature also has a good share of the blame for this because they didn't put any of the checks and balances in place when they gave them the money. They just dumped it on them as part of their attack on public education. And, again, my husband called for a summer study commission to look at this before the Daleville story came out, and it passed. And they didn't create it.
Well, it
they're not interested
the
in accountability.
As I recall, the last 2 years' sessions, not just this one, but the two prior, there were bills that would have, in fact,
put new restraints.
They're
not interested in finding out not only the fiscal responsibility part of it, but the results of it. I mean, all of the theory behind choice was it's supposed to result in a better education and a more efficient education. We don't know that. And we keep putting huge increases in the funding for this. What's wrong with that picture?
It's economic development, right?
Yeah.
At least
for the
companies.
Friends for the friends of the people get operating.
All right, Indiana
schools.
Officials closed the book on the 2019 fiscal year this week, and the state has more money in reserve than it's ever had before.
Indiana took in significantly more tax revenue than expected in the past year, with revenue growth the highest it's been since 2012. That puts the state's budget reserves at nearly $2.3 billion, and Governor Eric Holcomb wants to spend some of it. He's asking the legislature to okay $300 million from reserves for several projects already in the planning stages. The projects include a new swine barn at the state fairgrounds, several university projects, and the completion of U.S. Highway 31.
And Delaney, even with Governor Holcomb's spending proposals, does the state still have too much in reserves?
It not only has too much in reserves, his spending proposals mean he needs to go take a class in economics. What he's doing is building buildings, which is fine, and building roads, which is fine. But generations are going to ride on those roads and do those buildings, and that's why you bond.
Money if you pay for it?
No, you don't, because the interest rates are so low right now.
Right
and you
now.
Can't. That's when you lock in
true.
The bond,
yeah,
okay? And instead of having the two buildings and one road, we could do 10 buildings and 5 roads. It is so narrow.
It would
narrow
not be as
thinking.
Fast, though. The process would be more drawn out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, to a certain extent.
We don't know how even
if Governor Holcomb's spending proposals are approved, which we expect they will be, the Republican legislative leaders expressed support, they would still have reserve levels of over 12% when throughout the session they were saying 11 to 11.5 is good.
Is plenty.
Is it still too much in reserve
yes.
at this point?
No, I don't think so. I think, well, look, I mean, we don't want to end up like Illinois and California and all these other places. So we are conservative about it, which Hoosiers appreciate. And Republican leadership has brought us to this place. We're not going to go just spend all this extra money because it looks like today we may be in better shape. And it's very
wise.
That's
why you invest in capital projects.
Well,
that's why he's
talking about putting it in capital projects.
But not
as opposed to taking on debt service, which by not, because these things were already planned for. So this isn't a new idea.
So
they
were
already
planned
for.
So you already have the money that was set aside for the future for them that could go to something else.
I just want to point out that during the session when we were talking about what percentage of reserves, I asked Brian Bosma, the House Speaker, pointedly, and he said if we had more than 12% in reserves, that was irresponsible, that we should be spending that money.
Finally, the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team won its fourth World Cup title, defeating the Netherlands 2-0. They've already said they won't visit the White House to celebrate that victory, even if invited. So, Jennifer Hollowell, do teams, especially national teams, have an obligation to accept those sorts of invitations from the White House?
No, I don't think it's an obligation, but I do think it's an opportunity, and I think it's a real missed opportunity to not go. I think it's unfortunate. You didn't see players who were more conservative or Republican not going when President Obama was in the White House. I think that if you have
kids,
maybe
a little bit,
but you haven't seen this kind of thing. Like,
don't
we all want to see people work together and talk to each other?
I don't think so. I think if money is free speech, voting with your feet is free speech too. And this isn't just a president. This is a president who is a joke. and who offends offends people across the spectrum with his language, with his conduct, with his personal conduct, I don't blame them at all.
Well,
I wouldn't want to go
either. In circumstances, opinion, they couldn't though. Go because this was not just a case of first impression. There had been this ongoing battle since the very first match of the World Cup. So for them to go now would be hypocritical, and it would be sort of a spectacle for different reasons.
Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.